So we move now to chapter 4 of Hosea. Hear the word of Yahweh. What's happening is, this is his understanding of what Yahweh is stirring him to say. Let's start. That's the first thing to say. And if that's all it was, we wouldn't know what to do with it, because we know from Jeremiah, and later we'll see that, plenty of others, that there are plenty, we saw it on the first night, in fact, there are plenty of false prophets around saying, Yahweh says. Remember those texts? Yahweh, I didn't send you, says Yahweh. So we're dealing with the human condition here. Why is Hosea, when he claims that Yahweh is saying, why have people preserved Hosea, is the key question. And it was preserved, I can't give you all the reasons, of course, but it has been preserved, it has been read, it's still there, 2,800 years later, 700, being read, and so that the community has sensed in it an inspiring presence. That doesn't mean that everything that was in Hosea's head and that he said is absolutely inspired, infallibly correct, you know, free of error, and the last word on anything. None of this is the last word, we are saying it's inspired. There's a beauty in it. There's something quite special in it to give us insights into God and to give us insights into our behavior and what we should do and how we should respond to God. Imperfect, and you'll see other later, it'll grow, it's different prophets will have different things to say. So we're looking in it for what is of value. How do we know what's of value? Well, it's a big question, and we've got scholars all over the world trying to help us do that, and it's not going to be that easy. And the Vatican II said that it is without error. In that area, whatever God wanted put in there is without error. Well, what did God want put in there? So it's a discernment, and you've got to get to Jesus too. And then you've got to look back. You've got to read the Old Testament through Jesus' eyes or you won't get it right. Jesus said, it was said to you of old, but I say to you, love your enemies. You don't find that anywhere in the Bible. You can't find it in the Old Testament because their enemies are God's enemies, so you can't love them. In fact, the exact opposite. You should be opposing them and all the rest of it. They were wrong on that, but they were right on many other things. And if we can grasp what's right, and we see that actually by looking backwards, I think, for us as Christians, we see it by looking at it in the light of Jesus. We see the beginnings of a movement of insight into God that is fulfilled in Jesus, flowers in him, you know, is seen in him in a much more beautiful way than Hosea would have ever dreamed. But it picks up some of the beautiful things Hosea has said, but it also puts aside some of Hosea's oversights that belong to him as a man in his culture. So let's move on to chapter 4. Hear the word of Yahweh, O people of Israel, for Yahweh has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There's no faithfulness, there's no covenant love, there's no knowledge of God in the land. Now that's pretty big exaggeration, but that's what he's criticizing them for. Swearing, you go through the Ten Commandments if you like, swearing, lying, murder, stealing and adultery break out. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. Well, you've just seen a few of the assassinations that are going on in his time. Therefore the land mourns. That's why the crops aren't working, the sheep are looking a bit downtrodden, the cows are kind of, you know, looking a bit forlorn. Things are pretty grim. All who live in it languish, together with the wild animals and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea are perishing. So they're going through a difficult drought and all the rest of it. And this is how he sees it. It's their lack of knowledge of God. Yet, let not anyone contend, let not anyone accuse, for my contention is with you, O priest. Good, the priests are in trouble again. And this is what this is about too. In other words, the ones who should be there giving the Torah in the sanctuaries, they've bought into the system and they're not actually lost faith, according to him. They're carrying on the cult. O priest, You shall stumble by day, and the prophet also will stumble with you by night. And I will destroy your mother. God bless her. My people, a good line, my people perish for lack of knowledge. That rings true till, doesn't it? Don't know. Who's teaching? People perish because they don't know. Because you've rejected knowledge, I reject you as my priest. He's probably saying this in the Bethel sanctuary. And since you've forgotten the law of your God, the Torah, which is what they're supposed to be defending, I will also forget your children. In other words, I, God, will see, it's a bit tit for tat in the Old Testament. God seems to be like, you're bashing these people up, I'll bash you up kind of stuff. It's a bit primitive, as I read it anyhow. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me. They exchanged their glory for shame. They feed on the sin of my people. They are greedy for their iniquity. And it shall be like people, like priest. I'll punish them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. They shall eat, but not be satisfied. They shall play the whore. Now, whichever way you look at that, but it's basically metaphorical. They're false gods coming into their mind. But they will not multiply because they have forsaken Yahweh to devote themselves to whoredom, to worshipping false gods. So I've got to ask myself that, haven't I? And so have you. Is the God I'm worshipping God? Well, I hope it is a bit anyhow. Do you know what I mean? But it won't be fully aware. I mean, if we were fully aware who God is, we'd all be saints. God, there's a lot of saints in this room looking around at you lot. But, you know, I mean, we're on a journey of discovery, and we have to keep... Reformation has to happen all the time to us as people and to us as a community. We've always got to learn. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, we did that. Come, let us return to Yahweh, is the plea of the prophet. For it is he who has torn, he will heal us. All the punishment's coming from God. God's the only one who can reverse it. He has struck down, he will bind us up. And look at this. And after 2 days, he will revive us. And on the third day, he will raise us up that we may live in his presence. Does that ring bells in the New Testament? On the third day, it goes back, as I understand it, to that beautiful chapter 19 of the book of Exodus, one of the loveliest chapters in the whole Bible. And there he's talking about God on Mount Sinai. And the promise is that on the third day, God will reveal who God is on the mountain, Moses and the people. On the third day. So that third day becomes a symbol, a dramatic statement for revelation, for when God will reveal who God is. And so Jesus can say, without any foreknowledge of how long he'd be in the tomb and all that, that's, I think, quite irrelevant, he can say, yes, it's looking pretty grim, and he can see death coming, he can, because they're working at it. He knew what he was saying, and his persistence in it wasn't going to go very nicely over with the people. But he could always end up to the frightened disciples who didn't want to see the dream dashed. He could always end up saying, but on the third day, I will rise again. On the third day, God will take me to himself. And we know that of ourselves too. We keep talking about in our liturgy, it's a bit iffy really, but we keep talking about the last day. And I, when I was a child, I grew up thinking that when I die, or when anybody dies, they're kind of, I don't know, they're hanging around somewhere in a tomb, that bit, and their soul is whatever. And then on the last day, everything will all come together again. I mean, that's how I thought about it. I don't think about it like that now. And maybe I should. I don't know. How are you supposed to think about these mysteries? But I think death and time, there's no time after death. So death is a fact that we see. But on the third day, God will raise you and my mother and my father and my brothers and sisters and me when I die and you, so that it's beyond time. It's a faith that God will be revealed and God will draw us all to himself. We don't have to wait for that. So here we are. But that text is just one that echoes a bit for obvious reasons. That we may live in his presence. That's what God wants us to do, live in his presence. Let us know, he says to the people. Let us press on to know Yahweh. Know intimacy. Again, his appearing is as sure as the dawn. He's coming to us like the showers, like the spring rains that water the earth. And then you don't find this anywhere else in the prophets, as intimate as this. This is the feeling that Hosea has about God's feeling. See, I grew up with Aristotle's philosophy and Thomas Aquinas and all good stuff, loved it. But it was all God was very intelligent and intellectual, and feelings weren't anything to do with us, by the way, too. Our feelings were neglected entirely. I've made up for it since a bit, which you don't have to talk about. But anyhow, but in those days, how you felt wasn't really a question. It was you were trained intellectually and trained well, I think, but personal friendships weren't encouraged in the seminary, you know, for obvious reasons that they could go wrong. But if something can go wrong, you don't stop it. You make it go right, don't you? Mm. But there was a heck of a lot of just stuff that we didn't know anything about and didn't do. But the Bible doesn't let us do that of God. Look, this is God speaking. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your covenant love is like a morning cloud, like the dew, like yesterday's mist that hung around for a while, that goes away early. This is what I want, says God to the people. I want covenant love. That is a commitment, a marriage commitment, a love commitment. I want covenant love. I don't want your sacrifices. Now, he's not saying I don't want your sacrifices. Hosea didn't know that, but he's just saying, look, I don't want sacrifices if they don't come from this. You know, it's a matter of what's first. And I want knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. You're putting all your energy into religious cult and religious behaviour, but you're not getting to what it's all about, which is covenant love and knowing God, a communion, an intimate communion with God. Well, how did Hosea know all this? I think he knew it from his own personal life. In other words, he experienced, because of the difficulties of the marriage and his love and the disappointment and the going after the woman again, he kind of had a feeling for this that enabled him to have insights into God that you don't find elsewhere as beautifully. Woe to them, woe, and this is said with tears in your eyes, not, you know, woe to them, they've strayed from me, says God. They're not getting anything out of this, they're not better off for it. Destruction to them, they've rebelled against me, so they're going to end up being destroyed. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. They don't cry to me from the heart. They wail upon their beds. Oh, the Assyrians are coming. God, what are we going to do? But they gash themselves for grain and wine because they think the pagan gods will come and help them. And they rebel against me. But it was I who trained and strengthened their arms. Yet they plot evil against me. They turn to that which doesn't profit. They've become like a defective bow. He's full of imagery, isn't he? The bow that's just not working right, so the arrow can't go straight. Their officials shall fall by the sword because of the rage of their tongue, so much of their babbling in the land of Egypt. They've gone off to Egypt now to try and bring Egypt on side, and it's only getting the country into a mess, and Hosea can see it, others can see it, but the king's sick of it. A few little terms that you're familiar with, I think. They sow the wind, they'll reap the whirlwind. That's a bit of a saying that's around, isn't it? That's where it comes from. Hosea, it's been around for nearly 800 years. They sow the wind, well, they're going to reap the whirlwind. Though they offer choice sacrifices, though they eat flesh, Yahweh does not accept them. Now he'll remember their iniquity. He'll punish their sins. They will return to Egypt. In two senses, they've gone back to Egypt as against Assyria, but they're going back into slavery from freedom. Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces. Judah has multiplied fortified cities, but I'll send fire upon their cities. It shall devour their strongholds. I'm selecting here, obviously. Israel cries, the prophet is a fool. A man of the spirit is mad. That's what they're accusing him of. The prophet, he says, is a sentinel for my God over Ephraim. And now chapter 10 it is. Sow for yourselves justice. This links in nicely with Amos. Reap covenant love. Break up your fallow ground. It's time to seek Yahweh, that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. You've ploughed wickedness. You've reaped injustice. You've eaten the fruit of lies. Indeed, you trusted in your power and in the multitude of your warriors. They thought that building up armaments was their way to peace. Thus the tumult of war shall rise among your people, and all your fortresses shall be destroyed, as Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle, when mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Thus it shall be done to you, O house of Israel, because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel shall be utterly cut off. Is that towards the end of his life? Is it the problem with the last king of Israel, Hoshea, who was captured, and then the city of Samaria was put under siege? I'm not sure, but these are the events, the background events, that are behind his words.